My fellow man, it is time to greet you. It is time for me to extend my hand in friendship. It is time for me to salute thee on this great winding yellow brick road of existence. It is time for me to doff my cap to thee as thou preparest to get the pot boiling. It is time for me to say Ave, Hoy. Are you prepared for a deepie? No, I'm serious. You know, that very rarely in our daily life, very rarely, I've noticed this from the time I was 2 years old. Does anybody ever talk about anything important? They'll talk about music, you know, something that's big, and they'll talk about tax reform. They'll talk about politics. They call that big, you know. They'll talk about the future of the Democratic Party. That's considered very important. Well, I submit to you, nobody even knows what parties they had in ancient Egypt. And I'm sure there was a lot of talk about that jazz, too, at the time. There was a lot of hoopla about the newest pharaoh that just came into power. And I doubt very much whether we often think about it or whether it had any impact on our world at all, the newest pharaoh that came to power. And so I have come to the conclusion that we rarely ever talk about anything important. We rarely do. Even when a guy's on giving a sermon, he rarely does. He usually talks in rote. You know what I mean by rote? You know, that they get that tone in the voice, you know. And I say to you, my fellow man, this is not serious talk. That's just loud noises, which is very different. And before we go, now serious talk, you see, I'm telling you what it does, is different from a lecture. In other words, a lecture is not often serious talk. In fact, it rarely is. A lecture merely is a guy getting up there expounding on what he believes. Now, he's not involved in talk. I mean, he's just saying, I believe that if you take the square root of the hypotenuse and he goes on and on, fine, all right, you either accept it or you don't, you know, that's the end of it. But actually serious talk about what what the nature of things is and are, were and will be, is rarely ever entered into in the average day of the average man. I would venture to say that most people can live their entire lives out without having 10 seconds of real serious talk about what it's all about. I'm convinced of this. And as a matter of fact, I can also say this, that anybody who does ever do these things is usually looked upon as immature or a kook. Well, that's a curious paradox, that a kid of 12 walking around looking up at the sky and looking at the horizons bending off forever can say to himself with almost total impunity from criticism, what is it all about? Why are we here? What's at the other end of it all? And, you know, people say, well, he's a kid, you know. Implying either they know what's at the end of it all or what it's all about, or it's ridiculous even to talk about it. Which do they mean? Well, it's very hard. I'm sure a lot of guys already listening to the shows, oh, here's a kook. And they're off looking for somebody playing string music or giving the news, which they think is important. You know, if people really think newscasts are important talk. In radio, they have this illusion going constantly that they're doing something very important when they rush in and tear 3.5 minutes of jabber off of the newswire and put it on, that they have done a gigantic important thing. There's a bustling sense of importance about a newsroom that you just can't match anywhere in radio. And yet they're probably involved in the least important of all activities at a radio station, ultimately. And if you don't think this is true, have you ever dug out of the files, any of you guys in the newsroom who happen to be listening to this on a radio station, have you ever dug out of the files a newscast of, say, 2 years ago and see just how much importance any of this stuff really is? Even the ancient battles have no importance. They really don't, you know. World War II didn't change anything. We're all still walking around scratching. The same hates persist. It didn't change anything. It just killed a lot of guys. It's about the end of it. A lot of airplanes went down. A lot of boats sank. There was a lot of excitement. It provided endless film footage and tremendous basis for a lot of TV shows. But as far as actually doing anything and changing it, I doubt it. Very much so. And so if you take out an old newscast, you'll find that it's just jabberwocky. Oh, today the city council announced that parking meters were blah, blah. And it goes on and on and on. And it's of passing interest, but that's what the term passing interest means. It's of passing interest. And you rarely hear any real talk about why. What is it? What are we? This is never discussed. Once in a while, somebody from, some radio pulpit will say, "And I would like to answer the question of what man is. I suggest that you turn to Ecclesiastes 7, chapter 4. And he goes on, and he comes on with some answer that is in a parable form. Maybe it's in rote. And I'm not putting down the Bible, so don't get all excited. I'm merely saying, though, that he's not really talking about something. He's parroting something which he has believed and which a lot of other people believed, but it does not necessarily get down to the basic questions, which we rarely ask. And before we go any further, there is nothing more serious in this very serious world of radio than the serious commercial, friends. All right, now the question, of course, immediately, the only thing really that is of genuine importance to us, I'm talking about genuine importance to us, is what is man? What really is he? And there you will find the basis. That question, that one arguable question, has formed the basis of practically, well, in fact, all philosophies. They argue it endlessly. It ranges all the way from the Thomists on one end to the existentialists on the other. And I'm not philosophy name dropping here. It's a great wide range of opinion about what man is. Now, most generally, they're concerned with what is man as a social creature. They argue endlessly about the social structure that man creates. In other words, the society he lives in, the kind of government he has, the kind of familial unit that he exists in, the kind of organized activities that he takes part in, factories, homes, schools, one thing. What is education? Have you ever asked yourself about that? What really is education? It's a pretty fascinating question, and not so simply answered. So somebody will say, well, education is, many people will tell you that education is literally learning about the past. Now, you will find this is really, in a sense, what it is. Now, what is the past? Well, the past can be what a large number of men have found out about, let's say, the ferrous metals. Now, you'd like to say to yourself, well, I'm being educated because I'm learning about ferrous metals. Not necessarily. You're learning about what men have thought about ferrous metals, which is quite a different thing, as anyone who has followed the history of science knows, that what men think about a thing at any given period in time is quite often subject to radical change the next semester. And so don't assume immediately that since you do know about ferrous metals, that you know about ferrous metals. That's a very rash assumption. Now, on the other hand, people will say, well, no, education isn't that at all. That is a trade. What you are merely learning there are some tools when you learn ferrous metal. Education is learning about man. Well, now that's another interesting question. You mean to tell me that by reading Milton you'll learn about man? You will learn more about Milton than you will about man. And you're going to say to yourself, well, Milton is a man, and if I learn about what Milton is, then I learn about man. Is that true? Or are you only learning the part that Milton will let out? Or the part that can come out, which is even more important? He's not hiding anything, essentially. I'm confusing the whole issue here. People are getting really excited. Now, if you say, well, I believe that education is learning about the past achievements of man and the past frustrations, and I feel that by learning these things, I can avoid them in the future. Well, I submit to you that the men who started, let's say, the Revolutionary War knew about history, and yet they had a war. I mean, they knew about the Tunisian or the Punic Wars. They knew about the Peloponnesian Wars. They knew about a few things, too, you know. In fact, in many cases, more than we do. Because they had a classical education that really hung on that world. They really knew the world of the Greeks, or at least as much as we think we know about them. So now the question arises again, what is education? You say, well, education is something, and then you'll go into the real philosophical realm. Somebody say, well, education is a means for me to communicate better with my fellow man. Well, I have found in my experience, and many other people have too, that the more educated a man is, the less he is able, really, eventually to communicate. That Einstein, for example, a highly educated man, could hardly communicate with anybody around him. Even his housekeeper had trouble. And I wasn't just talking about quantum mechanics, either. They had trouble talking to him about cleaning his sweaters. Now, this is a very, very, very difficult problem. And people are prone to say, well, I know what education is. It's teaching people how to act. Well, now, that's an interesting point. Is it? Because the way we act today may be considered sheer barbarism to the people of 300 years from now. See, I think the trouble is with most discussions that are, quote, serious about what man is and what he feels and how he behaves, is that most people are bound by time. Most people feel in terms of one area of time alone. And so you'll notice, because there are endless magazines talking about the 20th century as though the 20th century is the most important century, that nothing else happened before and nothing else really of importance will happen afterwards, that this is the great century. Well, this is an illusion that all men have felt throughout all time, that any time they're living is, of course, defined by them as the most important time. And to them it is, obviously. They're around at that time. But be careful. This is a snare, a delusion, and a trap. it really is. Now then you could go into such a question as, what is time? We're not even going to touch on that today. That's a subject for another hassle. What is it? Oh, you can get endless fights and bars started, but this is not what I call a serious discussion. Once in a great while, something really important will be mentioned by somebody, and it will usually appear back on page 75 of the newspaper, if at all. If it appears at all. Most papers don't even print it. This is ridiculous stuff. They're all hung on whether or not the tax levy is going to go through for the new schoolyard. They're all hung on whether or not De Gaulle is going to make the announcement today. They're all hung on whether or not the basketball team is going to win. And that is what is called important news. That's important discussion at any given time in history. Now, have you ever had the opportunity to read newspapers that were printed during epical periods? By epical periods, I mean periods that really change the course of mankind's journey towards wherever he's going. Well, you'd be appalled to find they hardly ever mentioned it. You would be appalled to find that during the great days of the Freudian ferment, when Freud was revolutionizing a whole way of looking at man, it was never mentioned in the newspapers. It wasn't important enough. It just was not important. And so thousands of newspaper men were running around Vienna and interviewing various generals, interviewing various politicians who were talking about widening the main street, endless guys who were making comments about Germany and Switzerland, and they were running past this little house where this little guy was sitting there turning out his little papers, and who gave a damn? Well, be careful. Don't always assume that the most important news of any given period can be found in the editorial pages or on the front pages of that paper. That during the days when the Wright brothers were experimenting with their airplanes, you know that no one could be coerced even to come and watch them do it. In fact, there are some interesting letters by Orville Wright, who tells about how hard he tried to get newspaper men and that to come to watch them, because he felt if they could do that, they could get investors interested. They were not interested. These were a couple of kooks down there. Forget it. They're not going to come down there and watch it. And so they missed the chance of watching that first plane rise off the ground. They missed it. And even for years afterwards, they missed it. They kept looking at it as a curio. They can, oh, you know, it's a carnival trick and the little things like that. Completely missing the point. And I submit that most of us, man, including me, everybody else, miss the point of their time as fantastically. Although we like to believe that in our period, you know, people are very hip, they know about this, they don't miss points, do they? I wonder what points we're missing right now. It's staggering when you think about it. And the guys coming 300 and 400 years from now will say things like, wouldn't it have been fascinating to have lived at that time when this great man was working or when that great man was around? And I would venture to say that we, most of us, know nothing about this great man. And now we assume that it's somebody who's writing. We assume, you know, some guy novelist. We assume right now that we know about him. When even as I say this, you say, yeah, but I know about him. I know all about this famous atomic scientist, or I know all about that famous chemist, or I know all about that famous novelist. I'm talking about the guy that none of us know about. And I'm talking about the concept that none of us know about that is quite possibly evolving in somebody's mind and at the end of somebody's typewriter that could very... Because you know that nobody knew what Karl Marx was doing in the neighborhood where he was sitting up there over the piano factory writing Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto. You know that? That nobody in the neighborhood knew what this old bearded nut was up to. That's what he was. He was considered an old bearded nut. He was considered a recluse. He was like a hermit. And he would, year after year, he's up there writing away, you know, and looking out of the window and swearing and writing away. All right, go ahead and laugh at that old bearded nut down there at the end of the street. They've laughed at other bearded nuts down at the end of the street, I'll tell you that. There have been several, friends. And before we go any further, speaking of the nuts, it's time for commercial, Will. There it goes. Oh, it's now let's get down to the basic raison d'être for this show here. What we're getting at here. How do you look at man? How do you look at yourself? Now I'm saying apart from your family, apart from the hang-ups of whether or not Howard loves you, apart from, you know, that kind of jazz. I'm serious. What do you think of mankind in general? You know, there's two completely diverse schools of thought that generally run parallel, and sometimes they intertwine. One school of thought, of course, holds that mankind is this fantastically beautiful creature, this greatest of all creations under the arching firmament, this infinitely majestic being capable of unbelievable and untold monumental achievements. Man, in short, is the most beautiful of all things. And in fact, this version often holds that man was not created in God's image. It was quite the other way around. And for that reason, that's why our God looks like a man and not a chipmunk. And, oh, we salute thee, oh great man. Okay, all right, now that's one version. This is held by most people very strongly. This version, of course, also says this. Now, remember this. There is the concomitant result of this that says man is basically that fantastic, beautiful creature. But there are forces that keep him from achieving that, namely the other rotten ones. Either that or man has not fully realized his potentialities. One day we will do this. Now that is a very deeply held idea. Then there's the other idea. That man is an insane, gibbering idiot. Not even an idiot. Just a mewling, puking animal amidst the great, grand, fantastic, totally complex universe that is meaningless, obscure, and a thing of chance and chaotic random dice throwing. So hold the existentialists. So hold the absurdists. So hold a large body of philosophical thought today. This is the thought of the random universe that is merely there, and that all we can do is bay at the moon. All we can do is pick our ears and gibber like the very apes of the field. And in fact, that's literally what we are doing, except we don't recognize our gibbering as gibbering, nor do, on the other hand, the apes recognize their gibbering as gibbering. It is a fully and logically thought out process of communication. And so man clings in the trees of his own jungle, gibbering away, crying out at the moon, swinging at stars that fly overhead, not comprehending, dull, chaotic. Okay. Now, which do you hold? This is a basic course in Philosophy 1 here. Which do you hold? And the war, the philosophical and theological wars have raged over those questions eternally, continually and eternally. And no one quite can make up his mind. And certainly you're looking at one right here. And yet, I must ask this question. Is either one or the other true? Could it be that both are totally false? Could it be that there is no true or false involved here? Could it be that there only is the is? You see, man is prone to make value judgments. Is this a product of man? In other words, is it something that we have created? Is there a good and is there an evil? Is there? It's a very difficult thing to say here. Now, there is one body of opinion that will say, no, of course not. Any enlightened man recognizes, be careful. This leads into some pretty fascinating philosophical collisions then. At one point, you know, during the mid-1930s, there was a great body of German philosophers who held that there was no ultimate good or evil. And they were able to convince enough people, so they wound up building gas ovens. Be careful. But then you can pull back far enough away and say, well, is that bad? Well, be careful. It depends on whether you're fed into the oven. So, you know, we're getting into some really, really deep waters here now. On the other hand, many people will say, of course, there is a good and there is an evil. And here they are, and they will trot out the lists. They will trot out the various things that are inscribed on pillows that have been woven in cross-stitch. They will bring all these things out and show you what the good and evil are, and yet any good philosophical historian will show you that the good and evil concepts have changed practically almost daily throughout history. That what was good 1,000 years ago no longer is. And you're going to say, well, they weren't enlightened people then. Well, strangely enough, they were enlightened about the people 1,000 years before them, and they thought that at that time they had arrived at the ultimate good. So here we go. Of course, there is the illusion, and this must be brought out right here, of any given time feels that whatever it believes, I'm talking about the great body of man, not just one political party or one group, one nation, the great body of man in the world at a given time, let's say in the mid-1960s or in the mid-1060s, whatever those people are, they can't comprehend of any other way of being. Really. And they have great suspicions about it. Even if the way of being that they're living in is full of vast evils, is full of tremendous winds of evil and cruelty. And so a man living at the time, let's say, of 800, the year 800 roughly, when there was great barbarism throughout large areas of Europe, defended barbarism. Because it was a known thing, and not only was it a known thing, it was the only thing he could comprehend. This is the way people are, in short. Well, are they? I don't know. We're not that way now. except we are and we aren't. Be careful. I'm asking you questions that go far beyond just, well, we don't do this. As somebody will say, well, look, we don't hang people like we used to. Well, we do other things, though, that are our own form of cruelty. Now, I'm not talking about little things like racial prejudice. That's greasy kid stuff compared to what I'm talking about here. For example, let's just take a little example of automation that somebody pointed out recently in a magazine article. I believe it was in Look, one of the magazine articles about that. They said that in the early 1800s, when the Industrial Revolution hit England, the first thing that all the manufacturers did, they saw, gee, the fantastic profits with this new steam-driven equipment, and they got 10-year-old children in to run this stuff. Then they could do away with all the skilled workmen that they had before, you see, which gave them great profits. And this magazine article submitted that the same thing is going on today, that now the new computers have come in, so the industry hurries and rushes to do away with all the people that it can do away with, thereby making more profits for itself and proclaiming, as the manufacturers did in the year 1830, that this is the best of all possible worlds, and that's the way it is to be, that anybody recognizes that this is an innate good. And they did that, you know, that a man hiring 10-year-old slave labor in 1830 thought he was doing good things for people. He says, why, they'd just be running around the streets, these urchins. I'm telling you the truth. And he really did think it. He wasn't being cynical. He thought it. And so we are doing literally the same thing in our own way. But at any given time, it is hardly ever possible to define the evil that you do by yourself. You can define evil and good by the past, but it's very hard to define what we're doing now because it takes perspective. Now, on the other hand, is it good and evil? Because it's being judged by another people. And so we're judging the 1830 industrialists by our world. Well, his world is gone. It's a totally abstract question. And it's a nonsensical question, really. It's an Alice in Wonderland question. Speaking of Alice in Wonderland, friends, well, now we're, you know, this is the kind of show that really, I wonder what in the devil. Now why am I bringing this up? Well, okay, I'll tell you this. Then I'm a great reader of the last pages of newspapers where you'll see these little things hinted at. And recently in the New York Times, there was an article that appeared way back. Boy, it was on page, crying out loud, let's see, page 62. Now, you know that a paper generally judges the importance of its pieces by where it puts them in the paper. And so as you get further back in the paper, the importance is less and less. And so here was this piece bracketed by funeral parlor ads and ads for clearance sales at Macy's and one thing and another. And it's way back on page 62. And furthermore, it did not appear in the second edition of the paper. That meant that it was just boilerplate, something they were just filling with. Listen to this piece, if you want to hear boilerplate, boy. It's datelined Montreal, and the writer is obviously a Canadian writer, John Osmundson. It's a special to the New York Times. That's his byline. Beautifully written piece, by the way. So he should get a byline. Montreal. A distinguished biologist and philosopher of science. You know, you rarely hear, now I must interpolate here a little footnote before we go. You rarely hear what a scientist thinks of mankind. Now, they'll talk about the future of technology. They often will talk about the future of, you might say, their field. They'll discuss the future in physics, the future in biology, or the future in ecological study, something of that nature. But here is a very interesting kind of scientist. And I believe there's a new emerging type of scientist. Listen to this. A distinguished biologist and philosopher of science. That's a rare type. Charged here tonight, that's in Montreal, that present-day biology is almost completely irrelevant to the study of the nature of man. Now, he's talking about the study of biology. We all studied biology a little bit. We took it in high school, you know. They tell you about the spleen and the lungs, and they talk about how the skeleton works and so on. This scientist, Professor René Dubos of the Rockefeller Institute, said that, quote, biological characteristics which are woven into the very fabric of the human race and which condition all aspects of human behavior have been grossly neglected by biologists and psychologists for the last 40 to 50 years. Now, where did you hear that? Well, I submit you heard that a long time ago here. That I believe, and I think you must have thought of it too. A lot of people have thought this, but you rarely hear it discussed. In other words, he is saying that various things that are in us are ignored. Now, I must say, in defense of another school of philosophy here, this is getting to be a seminar, that's only in our world. That's only in the Western world in a specific area. We're Freudians here in the United States and in Canada. But now there's another school of philosophy. There's several schools. The Pavlovian, on the other hand, does not necessarily ignore all of those things. I submit to the professor. However, we go on here. Professor Dubos attributed that neglect to the way in which biologists had come to treat the human body as, quote, a complex but otherwise ordinary machine, and to the widespread attitude of biologists that, quote, detailed analysis of the body's elementary structure and energy mechanism is the only valid approach to the understanding of a living organism, end of quote. The New York scientist asserted that this attitude had discouraged research into the sort of biological problems that cannot be analyzed with such, quote, reductionist analytical methods now in vogue among experimental scientists. Now, I hope this show is not boring you, because it gets this. You know, have you noticed that the more deep it gets, often people get bored? What is this boring when you're talking about the real thing? For example, Professor Dubos said that the techniques we use to study man today would not permit the study of those physiological urges that have been passed on through the generations since the caveman, but that are not manifested under normal conditions of modern civilization. In other words, what do you have packaged inside of you that has not come out yet, that goes all the way back to the caveman days? Now, don't always assume that it's an evil thing. Everyone says, well, no, a killer, one thing. Be careful. What do you have that your life just does not allow to come out? What do you have? Well, he says, we don't know. We have not studied this area, because we are all bound by civilization in one way or another. And he goes on to say, he said that the proper study of man's nature should concern itself with the evolved patterns of physiological responses to a changing environment, what he would call a new science of humanistic biology. In other words, you can see, he's talking about evolving as man evolves. Now, you know, people like to think, and we got a couple of commercials. Before we do anything else, let's give a commercial here. Now, we like to think that evolution has stopped. This is a very common feeling, that man was at one point this funny creature. Now, if you are an evolutionist, he was this thing that finally evolved out of this group of animals, came out of the mud, and now he's here, and he's finished, and he's ready. Well, now, the professor is saying, in one way, that evolution with man could be different than it is with other animals, in that man's evolutionary process could also include his societal evolution. In short, you look at an old movie, and you see in the 1920s, it looked different than it does now, doesn't it? And I'm not just talking about the buildings, I'm talking about the people, the kind of clothing they wore, the way they acted, and so forth. He said this could be part of evolution, really part of evolution. We could be evolving even as we watch. And then he goes on to say, not only would this approach turn up much new knowledge about, quote, humanness. That's an interesting word. What is the humanness that we have that, say, the giraffes don't have? He said it would also provide a better understanding of the uniqueness of the individual. In short, why I am different from Fred, and why Myrtle is different from Mabel. It's not just that you have a different body. He said there's something else going on here. Central to Professor Dubos' concept of a humanistic biology is his statement, quote, all aspects of behavior are affected by physiological processes. Do you hear that? All aspects of behavior are affected by physiological processes. Now, I would like to submit to you this, too, that this also includes such things as artworks. Quote, concepts of truth, that many a writer is bugged with society because he's 3 feet two. Many a writer wants to change all of society because he's 5 feet three and has bad skin. Now, it is hard for you to know this as you read a writer. It is hard for you to know that maybe he's got an axe to grind. Maybe he doesn't know he's got an axe to grind. In fact, in almost all cases, he doesn't. But one of the most combative, angry writers I know today, and he's world famous, by the way, and he's supposed to be a great benefactor to mankind, is about 5 feet 1 inches tall. He's very angry about that. He's been fighting people who have been taller than he is all of his life. And the first thing that he does when he gets in a party is try to get in a fight with a guy who's over 5 feet one. And yet, he's the guy who writes continually about peace. Now, I'm curious about that. Now, these are things which Professor DuBose here touches on very lightly. Then he goes on to say, here is something interesting. Central, he says, and those physiological processes, that's our physiological being in the process of the physiological animal, are inextricably tied to the evolution of man. Now, as an example, here's what he gives. For example, Professor DuBose said, man's physiology is linked to the movement of the earth around the sun and to the movement of the moon around the earth. We rarely hear anybody discuss that aspect of us. We cannot escape gravity. What does it do to us? We cannot escape the changes of the season. Yet a lot of writers like to pretend you can. You live in an air-conditioned home, and you live in an air-conditioned world, and your whole hothouse world of J.D. Salinger evolves. And yet that moon is moving over those people. That sun moves over Seymour just like it moves over all the rest of them. He cannot escape it. And he goes on to say this, man's responses to any situation, quote, are different in the morning from what they are at night, and different in the spring from what they are in autumn. Now, you've heard me say that. I've felt this for a long time. I think you have too. But it's never talked about. Somehow, psychology, it goes on, and a guy lying on a couch at 2 p.m. talking to a psychologist is treated the same as a guy lying on a couch talking to a psychologist at 2 a.m., and yet the doctor says he could be very well two different creatures. At least he has two different behavioral patterns, which is very important. You've never heard a psychologist say, well, look, I'm going to have you come in for a session at 4 a.m., I'm going to have you come in for a session at 8 in the morning. I'm going to have you come in for one at noon. They just don't do this because this is what he's hitting at. We do not recognize man's response to conditions above and beyond his control, like night and day, like sun and moon, like wind and winter, autumn and summer. Yeah, look out. Very different. Very different scene. Most wars, by the way, have been started in the spring or in the summer. Are you aware of that? Oh, yes. Hitler attacked Poland on a beautiful day in September. Indeed, he will. And there have been dozens and dozens of cases of wars that began at a certain period of time. They can graph it and chart it. You want to hear more of this? Professor DuBose said, The orthodox approach is not suitable for the study of this phenomenon. He's right. He says that the study of this type of condition, this problem that has to do with the sun and the moon and the wind and the stars, has no place in the kind of study that's made today. He says you have to evolve a new kind of study to bring all these things in. And he's quite right. In other words, the psychologist would have to become also a meteorologist. You'd have to know something about these things. He couldn't just say, well, you know, the moon is up. Well, what do you mean the moon is up? What does it do? Well, the psychologist prefer to think it nothing. He says nothing. Well, the doctor says, forget it. And any good policeman will tell you that the calls come in a million times more during the full of the moon than they do at any other time. That's why they call it lunacy. the lunar. Speaking of lunacy, now, I'm going to have to, before we go any further with this, I'm going to have to say this. This is a two-part show. I don't often do two-part shows. But tomorrow, I will do the continuation of this discussion, because it is an interesting, to me, if you're bored by it, well, I suggest that, you listen to rock and roll or something tomorrow, but this will be a two-part show, a two-part discussion, because I'm fascinated by this. And oh, by the way, one thing I must say as a footnote immediately, I do not at any point consider myself an expert, or an official pundit in this world. However, I am a man alive. I am existing. I have observed certain phenomena. I have a modicum of education. I will say this, however, that the questions that the professor brings up are of infinite interest to me. I am fascinated by man. And I will submit to you the ideas that he has given out. I will also attempt at times to bring in other ideas that people have had about the same subjects. Now, how much time do we have here, Lee? None? Okay, well then we better put one more commercial in here before we, in a sense, pay off the show for tomorrow's denouement. You see, the professor goes on into a discussion of primitive man and the responses that primitive man must have had to his environment, which, by the way, were obviously as completely realized and integrated as our response.